Thank you very much, everybody. It's lovely to see you here. It's such a select group. I kind of feel a bit like the teacher at the front of the class, and somebody's going to suddenly say, can we go outside? Can we have the lesson outside? But I don't think we can quite do that in West One. There isn't probably a tree we can sit under. I'm not going to witter on. It's a fantastically big subject, a wonderful time to be talking about it, because as I'm sure many of you are aware, this week at the G8, there was much talk about oil and strategic oil reserves, and today there have been talks with Iran about ending their nuclear enrichment program and so on. So oil is on, I think, lots of people's minds. And we've got two fantastic people here to talk about all sorts of aspects. I'm going to begin by Raphael, if I may. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the big themes in your book, pipelines, flowing oil, and crude politics. It struck me when I picked it up, this wasn't something I'd ever given a great deal of thought to. I've thought about the price of oil, about all the sort of oil shocks and so on, but not where it comes from. And at the beginning of the book, you say, the vital nature of fuel transmission ranks among key geopolitical elements that now regulate relations between states, which actually is something that once you think about it is very obvious, but I have to say it's not something I think we think about nearly enough. So I'm going to let you just give us a sense of some of the big themes in your book.
Okay. Good evening. What I'd like to do in a few minutes is look at some aspects of the book that focuses on the areas that Asia House is perhaps more interested in, namely South Asia and East Asia. And I've picked out three projects. I've picked out three projects to talk about here. Now, the first one is the so-called Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline. And I've put it, my cartographic skills are rather average, but I did put a little spur here towards Multan, which is a pipeline hub in Pakistan. I'm sorry, I'm not very accustomed to using these gizmos, but Ritala tells me if I make it point towards my chin, the sound comes out better, which I forgot to do. So what we have here is a pipeline that would have been carrying, originally it was supposed to carry 60 billion cubic meters of gas. Then between the three parties, they put it up to about 90 billion cubic meters. That is a large amount of gas. There have been all sorts of problems. The first has been, of course, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act in the United States. So, State Department has been lobbying very heavily. And in 2006, India was offered nuclear fuels by the U.S. Among other items of that would constitute a medium-term strategic understanding. And what this has led to, basically, is that India to more or less initially soft-pedal the project, and by now it looks like they've all but abandoned the Iran Pakistan-India pipeline. So the IPI is no longer. Still talking about the IP, India-Iran-Pakistan pipeline. There, of course, the same Iran Sanctions Act has been weighing in. Pakistan is obviously vulnerable, despite all the bluster, they're rather vulnerable to U.S. pressure, if only because their aircraft, their warplanes, are of U.S. make. So they depend on the U.S. for their spare parts, which is an important strategic consideration. Nevertheless, they have been, of late, declaring rather often that this pipeline is going to be built. So you can see, we're talking about natural gas, I mean, the stuff that you use for cooking at home. But we have State Department on one hand coming in, the aircraft spare parts being brought into the equation. We have Iran providing sweeteners in order to get this trade started. We've gone very far away from the simple commodity that is natural gas. We're talking international politics, geopolitics. Okay, the next one is one that State Department has much heralded, supported. It's the gas comes from Turkmenistan. It crosses Afghanistan. And I've tried to draw this one rather carefully because it is significant. Then it goes into, it goes through, eventually it ends up in Pakistan, and then there is a spur to India. And this is being pushed very hard by State Department. India has now made rather positive noises about this. They're actually talking about transit fees through Pakistan, as if this thing could really be built. Now, in my own mind, I've sketched out the following scenario. Imagine a lorry carrying fuel. Now this lorry, with its driver, starts moving from Mali in Turkmenistan up there somewhere, eventually comes out of the frontier, crosses into Afghanistan. It goes through Herat, and then starts going on the, well, on the Herat-Kandahar highway, passing through provinces called Farah, Helmand, and Kandahar. Now, you've heard these provinces before. But this fuel-laden truck is driving it along, and then it passes very close to Kandahar, and then it crosses into Pakistan. It goes up to 1,800 meters, the Bolan Pass. Goes across the Bolan Pass and then comes down onto the flats and turns left towards the pipeline hub in Multan, central Pakistan. Now, if I were to take bets with anybody so that is the story of the so-called TAPI, Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline. Now, the interesting thing about this project is that every time Iran really fires up the arguments about the Iran-Pakistan pipeline, the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline is pushed to the fore in order to provide a sort of diplomatic counterbalance. So these are my two large projects that I would suggest are not quite on the engineers' drawing boards.
They're your problematic pipelines.
Yes. Now, by contrast, we have here the Arakan coast of Myanmar, and we have, as we speak, under construction, a natural gas pipeline, an oil pipeline, and a railway line being built in parallel. And of course, you will appreciate building these things together. You're opening out a single route for all three facilities to pass through. So it does make technical and economic sense. But nevertheless, it's a large project. It's about 12 billion cubic meters of gas from Myanmar. Considerably shortens the way. The pipeline is for about 20 million tons a year, and then there's the railway line. And before, I think I've taken too much time already, but I mean, it sounds like a nice project. I'd like to quickly read for you what an Indian commentator wrote about this. That should give you a flavor of the implications of this project. This may enable China to exercise greater influence in South Asia, much to the discomfiture of India, and to counter the US naval presence in the Indian Ocean region. The prospect of using the same rapid mobilization of troops by the same the author means the railway, of using the same for rapid mobilization of troops in the name of securing its pipelines cannot be ruled out. It could also facilitate China reaching out to the Indian Ocean. As for India, it needs to keep a close watch on developments in Myanmar, especially pertaining China's growing footprint in the country, and accordingly enhance its preparedness to meet with any eventuality on its eastern front. With that, I'll leave the floor. Thank you.
There's plenty to hang on to there. What's clear is that oil, fuel is a source of conflict, a source of suspicion, and I think, Greg, that's a theme that really is runs throughout your book, Fuel on the Fire, All in Politics in Occupied Iraq. I mean, you're investigating the importance of oil to the war which unfolded in Iraq throughout the last decade. You really don't retain any sense of idealism.
That was something which really intrigued me about the book. My approach has been not to look so much at transit, but more at where the really large quantities of oil in the world are located. Now, I'm afraid I haven't brought you a map here. You can see just a tiny fraction of Iraq in the top left there, that little bit of green. but as you probably know, the Middle East contains the vast majority of the world's oil. Iraq itself contains 10% of the world's total known reserves. Iran contains another 10%, and three countries of the Gulf contain another 40% between them, primarily. think something that perhaps follows a similar course to what Raphael explores in his book is the way that, in the case of Iraq, oil has been the basis at times for prosperity and at other times for catastrophe. So, for example, by the end of the 1970s, Iraq had by far the best education and health systems of the region. I've met people in the countries around Iraq who would go to Baghdad to go to hospital for treatment because it was the best there was. That was really built off the revenue that Iraqis achieved from their oil through the 70s after nationalization, interestingly enough, when they were doing it themselves. That series of three wars and 12 years of sanctions, or 13 years of sanctions, has really brought catastrophe to the Iraqi people. And there's a similar parallel there, in fact. If you go back a few thousand years, Iraq was, as you probably know, the cradle of civilization. It was in that region. I'd like to make two other points that have struck me through my nearly 10 years of working in and on Iraq. The first is that I think to a significant extent because of that history. Engaged in trying to change those events, working together, organizing, whether that's in social groups, cultural groups, trade unions, and so on. And so that's one of the major themes of my book, and perhaps adds some relevant context to the events we've seen over the last 18 months in the region more broadly, in the uprisings against the region's corrupt governments. I was talking to someone about Iraq yesterday, who didn't really know anything about Iraq, and the first thing she said was, how did you work in Iraq? And I said, I worked a lot with Iraqi groups, civil society groups, like trade unions, for instance. And she said, civil society groups, trade unions, I didn't know there were such things in Iraq, because we're not told about these. And then someone else who was in the conversation said, I said I was working with Iraqis, she said, but which Iraqis, Shia or Sunni? And I haven't met, so I've met, I don't know, several hundred Iraqis over the last few years. I haven't met a single one who thought of themselves primarily as a Shia or a Sunni. All of them have thought of themselves more as Iraqi than a Shia or Sunni. In fact, the majority of them had either a spouse, a sibling-in-law, or a parent who was from the opposite sect, and many of them, what they've often said is that until they were adults, they didn't know there was a difference between Shia and Sunni. So the picture I've acquired of Iraq is very different from what we've seen in the media. My final point, clearly oil played a central role in the war and in the occupation, not in a simple way, in a complex way. And that's really the story that I've tried to tell of how that played out and how the struggles played out in the war. While I say it's complex, I mean, you don't have to get too involved in it in too detailed a way to see that. For instance, one of the people I interviewed was the State Department's senior advisor on Iraqi oil in the run-up to the war. And I said to him, so how much do you think oil played in the decision to go to war? And he said, what was it that Iraq had that we would like to have? It wasn't the sand. But I think the important theme that comes out for me in what I've seen of Iraq is that it's not the case that there was some nasty conspiracy. It's not the case that Tony Blair and George Bush sat in a room and said, yes, they cackled and said, let's tell them it's about weapons of mass destruction and let's go and steal the oil. I think what actually went on at every level, those involved in it, right from the top down to all of the officials who participated in it, was that what they saw and what they believed. I think that doesn't excuse him. I didn't think it was reasonable for him to believe that, but I think he convinced himself of that because it helped him to convince himself of that. And I think as they shaped Iraq in their interests, as they said, well, of course the Iraqi oil industry can't stand up for itself, so we'll have to advise them on how to do it, and they will need more financial. I think they went there expecting to see that it would need multinationals, and so that is what they saw. And the same with this sectarianism and the politics, as I said, it doesn't exist in a significant way in Iraq, it doesn't exist in a significant way in Iraq. Roots of that were in the political structures that were established by the Americans and the Brits. And I think, I don't think they sat in the dark room and thought, let's implement the right rule strategy. I think they went there and thought, and what they needed to see was that Iraq was incapable of governing itself. What they needed to see was that Iraq was divided and they would have to run Iraq towards Iraq. Than a simple conspiracy theory, for me at least. Anyway, thanks very much.
You've raised loads of things there that I'd like to pick up on, but I'm going to open the discussion up to the floor very shortly, and I think other people may want to pick up on some ideas. But I'd like to, just for a moment, explore a broader idea that, in a sense, is in both of your books in different ways, which is the question of ownership. I was very struck by the struggles at the beginning of the last century to establish ownership of oil fields by the Americans, by the Europeans, and then with pipelines, who owns a pipeline, and then at the end of the Iraqi conflict, who was going to have access to the oil fields. So how has this question of ownership
my overall impression, now that there are two things you have to consider when you're talking about oil extraction. First, the second is the oil. Now, the extraction is perhaps very easy matter. But in the Iraqi context, there's also the fundamental geographical problem that Iraq doesn't have obvious ways, routes for exporting its oil. So pipelines in the Iraqi context become even more important, particularly when the in situations when the Gulf was controlled by hostile powers, which has happened time and again during the past 15, 20 years.
Greg, that the chapter in the book where you describe the oil auctions is extraordinary. It's like the sort of national lottery or something, isn't it, the way it's done. The question of ownership was there throughout the run-up to the conflict, throughout the conflict, and indeed even to this day, people are still squabbling about who gets what.
The question of ownership is, I mean, for me, the just answer to it is that the people of the country concerned or of the region where the oil is extracted are the ones who ultimately have ownership over it. And in a kind of theoretical legal sense, that's the case too. In practice, that's not so much how it works. To illustrate that, I mean, I've visited Azerbaijan a few times, which features a lot in Raphael's book. And Azerbaijan had a major pipeline built about 6 or 7 years, a bit more than that, middle of the last decade, built running through to the Mediterranean to export Caspian oil to international markets, built by BP, a consortium led by BP. And this huge amount of oil was being extracted from Azerbaijan. The operations were led by BP. And Azerbaijan, like Iraq, has a longer history in the oil industry than Iraq. It goes back to the mid to late 19th century. The Azerbaijani technical skills were being ignored, and the Azerbaijani fuel needs were being ignored. All of this crude was leaving the country, going out through Turkey to the Mediterranean. And the country itself had a fuel shortage and was having to import refined products from neighboring countries. You see exactly the same in Iraq. Iraq is exporting crude oil, but the refined fuels, the petrol and the diesel, they're having to import from Iran or from Turkey. And I think what happens there is that when this is talked about in foreign policy circles, the question of what do the people who live in Iraq or Azerbaijan or somewhere else want from their oil, it never features. What features more is what does the world need? What and by the world, that's kind of code for the major oil consuming countries in the West. And so this goes back to what I was saying about people seeing what it's convenient for them to see. The idea of the Western advisors who went in to advise on how Iraq should develop its oil industry, they thought, well, you'd only have a nationalized industry for ideological reasons if you're a socialist or something. Of course, the practical, effective thing to do would be to have multinationals. Now, the Iraqi experience, and I hear this from most of the Iraqi experts who I know who've run the Iraqi oil industry, is that when it was most effective was when it was in Iraqi hands using Iraqi skills and they knew how to do it. When foreign companies did it, the foreign companies did it in their own interests. So from the Iraqi perspective, it's the other way around. If you want to be effective, in technical terms, you do it in an Iraqi state-owned company. The only reason you'd privatize is for ideological reasons. So it's the opposite.
But presumably, pooling of resources in technology is something that has to happen as technology gets more complicated.
May I ask you a question, the answer to which I rather suspect? What's happening to the income from the oil that is nominally going to Iraqi hands? Where is this money going?
The oil multinationals have been in Iraq for about 2 years. They arrived, they started operating mostly in early 2010. The money, on the face of it, above the table, the amount of money that the multinationals are getting is fairly small. It's a couple of dollars per barrel. What they're doing is they're using accounting tricks such as transfer pricing scams, to use their subsidiaries to carry out the work for them at inflated prices and then giving the bills to the Iraqi government. So they're profiting in ways below the table. The other thing that's happening is that corruption has reached absolutely staggering levels in the Iraqi oil industry. Now, it got considerably worse after from 2003 till 2010. But the degree of worsening accelerated once the multinationals arrived. And again, what we were led to believe by the newspapers was that it was the Iraqis who were corrupt, and what they needed was BPs and Shells who would be clean and responsible. And in fact, the destruction of Iraq's own capacity to make room for these multinationals has created conditions in which corruption could really thrive. So there's all kinds of criminals, militias, fake companies making profits in God knows how many ways, and Iraq simply doesn't have the capacity to oversee it and regulate it.
Would anyone else like to ask a question? There are plenty of questions to ask. There's lots of things we haven't talked about. Are you all shy? Oh, there's a lady here at the front. Oh, there's a microphone coming. Just wait for a second. It's just this lady here with the white T-shirt on the left.
Hi, my question is actually going to be about Turkey to Mr. Rafael. How do you think that, because Turkey, I think, is strategically important in terms of being a connection between Europe and Asia at the moment. So how do you think the evolving of the pipelines through Turkey is going to affect in the future its relation with Europe and the U.S.? Is it going to... And the second question is, what do you think about shale gas? Do you think that it actually can be an alternative to natural gas? Because I think it's going to, I mean, we are hearing that, you know, there's shale gas reserves, high reserves in Poland and Turkey too. So how is that going to play out in for the future of oil and natural gas? Thank you.
Now, a couple of summers ago, I was asked to comment on Turkish foreign policy regarding oil and gas transit. And the way I handled this, looking back, seems a little bit naive. I suggested that since Turkey did not have resources of its own, oil and gas resources of its own, and since it was not a major consumer, so it's neither producing nor consuming in a way at a level that would affect international markets, its position was one of passively trying to manage what may pass through its own territory. In other words, negotiate as best as it can, a position whereby it would get the maximum benefit from the consequences of decisions taken by others. Now, the last couple of years have suggested that the Turks can do a little bit more than just that. But let's not forget, Turkey is a debtor country. It runs a current account deficit on the order of $60 to $80 billion a year, second only to the United States. So it doesn't have money, doesn't have oil, doesn't have gas. All it has is geography. So I think the basic tenet, which I suggested, holds. But within that, there is a certain amount of maneuvering that they can do. For example, the project which they're reputedly about to sign with the Azeris, the Trans-Anatolian Pipeline, would, in the event, give them access to some more transit fees because they also own part of the line. But essentially, it is being funded by the Azeris, who cash rich and don't have the outlets for dispensing their cash. Now, so within that matrix, I seriously think Turkey's hands are constrained. They will have to wait to see what others do. But with having said that, they still have a certain narrow room for maneuver. They can say yeah or nay. They have, in fact, pretty much sabotaged the Nabucco pipeline project. Not that it needed much sabotaging by the Turks, because the Europeans never really put any money into it, nor did they put any political muscle into it. So it was a pipeline that was never going to fill up. It was never going to be built. Coming to shale gas, I mean, shale gas is not a substitute for natural gas. Shale gas is natural gas from shale. So now, do I think Turkey or anywhere else, you would, you'd have to find it. I mean, in Poland, just recently, I mean, the Poles went into this about 6 months ago with hammer and tongs. Very enthusiastic, they're going to find all the gas in the world. They came back out of their wells just recently, slightly red-faced, and said, well, we don't seem to have found all that much gas. They have plenty of shale, but...
Craig, you must have views on shale gas.
The point is, some shale contains hydrocarbons, other shales don't.
If I can bring Greg in, I mean, in America, it's brought the price of gas down.
Yeah, I mean, there's been massive growth in shale gas in the US, which is now spreading to oil trapped within shale. They're using the same extraction processes, and actually, you know, the famous Hubbert's peak, US oil production peaked in the 50s or 60s and has gone down ever since. Well, that turned around about 2 years ago because the shale gas boom led to the gas price collapsing. And so they thought, what are we going to do with all this hydraulic fracking equipment? Why don't we try and extract oil with it? And then they did, and then that started to increase US oil production as well. But I just wanted to say something about Turkey. You know, Turkey has strategically positioned itself as an energy gateway, as an energy hub. As Raphael says, it doesn't have significant quantities of oil or gas itself, but it's trying to be the gateway through which oil and gas from a number of other countries is exported. My view is that that's far more about politics than it is about economics. I mean, you mentioned the transit fees, Raphael, but I look in particular at the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan pipeline, which is the largest of these energy gateway projects. It's an oil pipeline from Azerbaijan. When that was built in the first half of the last decade, the Turkish participation in it was through a turnkey contract, a fixed price contract under which the Turkish pipeline company, BOTAŞ, had to build its share of the pipeline, which was the longest share, it was about two-thirds of the length. And they did it for a fixed price, meaning they took the risk, and for a cut price as a loss leader. They built it for less money, BP paid them less money than it actually cost them to build it. And so actually economically, they made a loss on the pipeline in spite of the transit fees. But what it does is it makes Turkey a very significant player in relation to Europe, because they can say, well, we've got all the oil and gas, and if you want it, you'll need a pipeline from us or a tanker from us.
I mean, just to add to that point, I mean, 2011, BOTAŞ made a net loss on their BTC pipeline operation. And it was always estimated, it was always thought, not just by the detractors of the pipeline, but just about everybody else involved, that pipeline, under those contractual conditions, was never going to make money for Turkey. Now, I would add another point to that, and that is The Turks went into it with open eyes. As far as I mean, 2005, 2006, I was, a bit facetiously, suggesting that Turkey could now withdraw the Third Army from eastern Turkey and leave it all to BP to protect. And that it has happened. There is no one now talking about snipping off eastern bits of Turkey for to give to the Kurds or anybody else. That has finished. So the political, I would reinforce your message that Turkish participation under those conditions was essentially strongly political.
Any other questions? Yes, there's a gentleman at the back.
Hello, good evening. Very fascinated to hear about the theories of Bush and Blair and their genuine honesty about weapons of mass destruction, whether it was well-intended or not, and I very much share that. But interesting to hear both of your thoughts. You talk about the international oil companies who have... you talk about the international oil companies who seem to be stealing a bit of a march on Iraq. But isn't it the case that the Iraqi people themselves and the ministers are very intelligent individuals? And I find it very difficult to understand that international oil companies can come in and exploit for super profits to the extent that you imply.
I said in my presentation that I greatly admire Iraqi intellectual and technical culture and what their engineers have achieved. Yes, Iraqis in general, the Iraqi oil minister, as was then, and the new one now, and the people underneath them, no.
They drove a hard bargain during those oil contracts, didn't they? They brought the price down.
What they did was they brought the price down on one side, above the table, under the table. And I think what happened was the oil minister at the time, who was the real architect of bringing in the multinationals, he wasn't an oil man, he didn't have expertise in oil, he was a nuclear chemist. He conducted a negotiation with BP, which was one of the first contracts. He conducted a negotiation with BP after the contract was won by BP. And what he did, and this came out from the WikiLeaks cables when they were released last year, the BP staff were going into the US embassy in Baghdad telling them what was going on, and we got to see this last year. BP said, yeah, it was amazing. He agreed to everything we asked for. And so while he had forced BP to accept a very low above-the-table figure of $2 per barrel, they'd done it by playing with all the detail so that actually it was the equivalent, and in fact one of the other companies said this, what we got at $2 per barrel was the equivalent of getting it under the old terms at the price we wanted. And I think what a large part of the reason for that was Shahristani, the oil minister himself, didn't have expertise in oil. And what he did was, because of the politics of the situation, what few experts he had left in his oil ministry, most of them had left since 2003, what few he had left, and this is what the WikiLeaks cable revealed, he drove out of the room and he said, I'm going to talk to BP by myself. I don't want a negotiating team here. I don't want oil specialists here. I'm just going to talk to them. And not being an oil man and not having that expertise, I think that outcome was almost inevitable.
I think this gentleman with the stripy shirt. Oh, sorry. There's also one just here. I think he was first.
Stripy shirt.
Yeah, sorry.
Hi, good evening. Just a quick comment / question. I sort of cover the oil markets, and in the last 6 weeks, I've been seeing a lot of oil coming from the new Basra oil terminal, and there's been a lot going to India and a lot coming to Europe, especially the Mediterranean. And this sort of, to me, is sort of in light with there's less coming from Iran now. So with the sanctions on Iranian oil, do you think there'll be more Iraqi oil coming in the Med? We're already seeing that, but I just wanted to check what you thought, how Iraq would play a more important role.
Rafael, do you want to?
I think we're in the middle of a propaganda tussle, not to call it a propaganda war. So all the messages coming out of Tehran would suggest that they're selling more oil than ever before. The Western media have been full of reports about how either Iranian sales are being curtailed or that they will be curtailed. And there's a lot turning around tanker insurance, because London is now, Lloyd's is no longer underwriting P&I insurance for tankers. And 2 days ago in Delhi, the government has announced its intention to provide P&I cover for their own tankers servicing Iranian oil. So I think I would not believe any of the reports coming out of anywhere just right now. We'll need to see when the dust settles down, the accounts can be made, and then, because I mean, there are any number of tankers floating here, there, and elsewhere, and under ordinary conditions, even a tanker of oil can be bought and sold maybe 20 times from the time it's reached its left port to the time it reaches the other port. So, I think we'll have to let things settle down before we can actually come to some judgment about whether the Iranian oil sales are being curtailed.
Greg, what's your view?
That's the Iranian side, if I can answer the Iraqi side of your question. Iraqi exports are certainly going to increase. They have been increasing and they will continue to do so. The reason for that is that from 2003 till 2010, there was virtually no investment in the oil fields, in the infrastructure, while it was still in Iraqi hands. And there is now investment, albeit coming from foreigners. Now, that's really a result of the dysfunction of the Iraqi political system combined with the occupation. There is investment, so more oil is going to be exported from Iraq. How much is going to be exported, that's a different question, and that's a very difficult thing to predict. If you believe what the contracts say, then in 5 or 6 years' time, Iraq will be producing 13 million barrels a day. Not very much. In fact, I haven't met anyone who believes that will happen, and I don't think it's at all possible. As I see it, the Iraqi oil industry at the moment, the picture is one of complete chaos. It's like a gold rush. Companies are trying to do what they can, and there's no structure to it. There's no organization to it. What will happen to the infrastructure? What will get approved and what won't get approved? And who will get which contracts? I think it's absolutely chaotic, and so it's very difficult to predict how much Iraqi exports will increase by, but they will certainly increase.
Can I ask a related and very idiotic question, but one which I'm dying to ask, which is, what does all of this possibly mean for the price of oil when you factor in the crisis in the Eurozone, you know, people talking about the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, tighter sanctions on Iran? Is there any way of knowing? Will it rise? Will it fall?
There we go.
Would you bet?
I've always said, like most people who know a little bit about these things, that trying to second guess fuel prices, not just oil, but fuel prices, is a very dangerous occupation. Having said that, I was asked that by the South Africans the other day, and they make synthetic fuel. Obviously, they want to know what the prognosis ought to be, so they ask everybody they can lay their hands on. Now, we are in the middle of a European financial crisis. The worst case scenario would see a crash that would, that's the worst case scenario, a crash that would reduce fuel consumption significantly.
That, well, I mean, in 2008, the price of a barrel of oil went down to about $34. And just when the likes of me were beginning to smile, it started shooting up again. I went up to 60, then 70, then it stayed for a while between 70 and 80. Now it's around 110. Much depends on demand. If one smooths out the economic difficulties in the West, and there is no big crash, I think one can expect a continuation of 1 to 2% increase per year in oil consumption. If that happens, that is always going to put a gentle pressure upwards on oil prices.
The only way is up, Greg.
What I would confidently predict about the oil price is either it will go up or it will go down, or it will stay the same. One of those three. And in terms of predictions, that's about as far as I'd be prepared to go. But what we can do, I mean, my view is the same as Raphael's here, which is we can talk about trends. I'm not going to give anyone a number for in 6 months' time or 2 months' time or 2 years' time. And, I mean, the economic situation is a very... It's a surprising one. We do seem to be in slightly different territory from where we have been before and where we might have expected to be now. After the oil price crashed in 2008 down to $40, I would never have imagined that it would climb back up to around 100 in the current economic circumstances. With economies so fragile, you would have imagined as it climbed back up, it would drive economies back into recession and then kill demand. Now, that isn't what's happened. The price has stayed fairly high. So it's difficult to judge there. But, I mean, one thing I'd say on the Iraq war, which I think is quite interesting, which is that the real strategic thinking, I mean, what I've looked at several hundred British and American government documents around the war and occupation, and what becomes clear from them as to how oil plays in it is that it's not so much about getting contracts for their own champions, you know, the Brits for BP and the Americans for Exxon. What it's more about, the strategic thinking at the in 2003 was more about how can we shape the oil markets to keep the price down. And their thinking behind that was we open up Iraq to foreign investment, that increases the flow of oil, and so the price stays down. Now, at the time of the Iraq war, the oil price was in the low 20s, and so if the objective of the war was to keep the price down, they didn't do particularly well at that. And what I find very interesting there was in one of the plan, or in a couple of the planning documents from the Pentagon, as to what they would do with Iraqi oil once the war started. What becomes clear is that there are two different views. One is those who say, well, actually, there's a really effective Iraqi oil industry. What we need to do is immediately after the war, we repair it, and then we let the Iraqis get on with running it, and that would cause the minimum disruption to oil markets. And there's another view, which is we don't even bother repairing it after the war. We let it crumble. We get the Iraqis out of the way, and that will make it easiest to bring in foreign investment and achieve that bigger strategic goal. And during the run-up to the war and the first year or two of the occupation, there was a constant tension between these two points of view. Rebuild the Iraqi industry, keep markets stable, keep the price contained, or play for the big one, get the multinationals in there, and change the shape of the oil market strategically. And ultimately, it was the latter that won out. But the consequence of that was that the price... It played a very major role. The war itself and its impact on instability in the region played a significant role in driving the price up to more than six times what it was at the time of the war in the space of 5 years.
Interesting thought there. There's a gentleman at the back.
Hi. Two questions, if I may. The first one for Raphael. You mentioned the TAPI natural gas pipeline. How do you think this will be affected? From what I understand, it's around a $7 to $8 billion sort of investment and project that's required. How would that be countered by sort of LNG, liquefied natural gas technology, and bringing that through the seas from America, where it's $2, per MMBTU into India, having to deal away with this high price. And sorry, my second question, if I may, for Greg, just to turn it around, we talk about the sort of political influences, which BP have done and possibly have brought about, but in terms of BP is quite a strong company. It's an ethical company, and it has controls. I mean, it's monitored by the shareholders. It does have accountability, and it does operate, let's say, in Abu Dhabi, where it does get the $2 a barrel, and is quite happy to do so. I mean, is it a question of more perception that it's inflating prices through transfer pricing mechanism, or is there something sort of harder facts sort of justifying them going in there? Because I mean, they could be perfectly happy with $2 a barrel and live take an ethical stance on it. Just an open question, really.
I think my difficulty with your question is your characterization of BP as an ethical company, and that's not something I recognize at all. In that, I mean, firstly, the way they've been playing the game in Iraq, which I can talk about in more detail perhaps afterwards. It was a few years ago, BP traders were convicted of market manipulation in North America. This is also the company which made a business model out of cutting costs so as to boost profits, with a whole string of accidents around the world, not just Deepwater Horizon, but refinery explosions, pipeline ruptures. I think even compared to its peers, it's pretty good at the public relations, but BP is, to me, by no means an ethical company. And I think...
Greg, may I add just one more point there? Now, in Alaska, now obviously we know that some of our international oil companies have been playing games in places where controls aren't very strict, like Nigeria, and the pollution there is unspeakable. BP is not necessarily involved there, but if you take Alaska, now there have been whistleblowers in Alaska since the late 1990s suggesting that BP was cutting corners in maintenance. These people were harassed in their homes. All sorts of things happened to them. They were fired, they were pursued. In 2006, 2007, there were huge spills from BP facilities in Alaska, and the verdict was that they had been skimping on maintenance. My own estimate, and this is more a guess than an estimate really, is that BP very deliberately in the second half of the 1990s decided to cut down on maintenance in order to save costs. And as Greg just suggested, I mean, there's the Texas City oil refinery that went up with, there were 15 people died there. There have been all sorts of accidents in Alaska. I mean, a few of them actually induced the federal government to step in and start looking at its own rule book. But certainly BP has been sailing very close to the wind. I would be a bit careful before calling them an ethical company.
And I, at this point, have to say the word allegedly, and if BP were here to defend themselves, I'm sure they would make a very good case for why they are an ethical company.
So... Well, I mean, I think if you look around the world, what you will see is that where the energy companies, or indeed any industrial concern, is kept in check by the public and by the home government, they will play it by the rules.
If you let them play it by their own rules, they are there to make money. It's not a question of ethics. I mean, the whole chain of command is geared to make money.
Raphael, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to ask you to briefly answer the second part of the question, which I have to confess I've forgotten, but I hope you remember.
Right. It was about the Tapi gas pipeline and supplying India with liquefied natural gas. Now, I think Tapi is not on. I've rehearsed the argument. I'm not going to go through it again. I mean, besides the fact, which I didn't mention, Tapi, once it crosses from Afghanistan into Pakistan, has to cross the whole width of Balochistan. Now, if you're following what is going on out there, there's at least one pipeline explosion there per week. Has been since 2006, since Nawab Akbar Bugti was assassinated by Musharraf's people. Ever since then, there's been low-level warfare going on in that area. So not even the pipeline would not even be safe after it crosses into Afghanistan. I honestly don't think conditions are would allow that pipeline to be built. About supplying LNG to India, it all revolves around the price. Now, in 2005, the Indians signed a very good agreement with the Iranians. It was a huge contract, and the Iranians were going to sell them natural gas. I think at the time it was about 10 billion cubic meters a year for 25 years. Well, it's a big contract, especially with LNG, because fixed capital costs of LNG installations are enormous. When Ahmadinejad got into power, he tore it all up. It was his campaign to clear up corruption, and the gas had been undersold and all that sort of thing. So that was one problem. Qatar has always insisted on a higher price, but India has been importing into the western seaboard. There are three installations, three Indian installations, and two of them are fully functional now. They're importing LNG from Qatar, but the price is high, and India has now almost completely abandoned its fuel subsidies, and they have a notoriously poor cash poor customer base. So there's a very difficult equilibrium to hold between whether the government helps the general population to do their cooking with clean gas or whatever. There have been problems. I think the major impediment to larger scale importation of liquefied natural gas into India is the price.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to stop there, Raphael. Greg, thank you very much. Thank you to all of you. I didn't even get to ask the question I wanted to ask about the strategic oil reserve. I'm very disappointed. I shall save that for later. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope to see you all here again.